A little over a year ago, the 9/11 Commission issued their report on the 9/11 terrorist attacks. In July, on the anniversary of the release, Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney held a hearing titled The 9/11 Commission Report 1 Year Later, A Citizen's Response, Did They Get It Right? About half of this fascinating hearing is posted on radio.indymedia.org. We have time for only a few highlights. We'll begin with Lori Van Auken, whose husband died in the World Trade Center on 9/11, and who has relentlessly sought answers to how this tragedy occurred. She gave a 50-minute appraisal of the 9/11 Commission report. Here is an edited version.
On the morning of September 11th, my husband Kenneth was killed while at his office on the 105th floor of the North Tower at the World Trade Center. We extend our sincere thanks to you, Representative McKinney, as well as to all of those who are responsible for setting up this hearing and giving us this opportunity today. On the morning of September 11th, I received the following message from my husband, Kenneth.
I love you. I'm in the World Trade Center. The building was hit by something. I don't know if I'm going to get out, but I love you very much. I hope I'll see you later. Bye.
End of messages.
From his words, I knew that Ken survived the impact of the plane. So I tried to call him back, but there was no answer. I fell to my knees in a panic, still clutching the telephone. A moment later, when the phone rang, it startled me completely. I prayed that it was Ken, but it was my mother. She told me to turn the television on. I told her about Ken's message. I told her that I couldn't reach him. I told her that I was very scared. I watched the TV in utter horror as black smoke billowed out from the building through a gaping hole the size of an airplane. I knew that Kenny was in that building. I watched as the people ran from the World Trade Center, hoping for a glimpse of my husband. Then the second tower was hit. As I continued to watch the breaking news, they showed the president sitting in an elementary school classroom, juxtaposed with the footage of the black smoke coming from the World Trade Center, along with people jumping to their deaths from the burning buildings. I screamed at the television, "Get up, President Bush, get up and do something." But he remained seated in a classroom of small children. I watched as Andrew Card whispered something to the president, and yet still my president remained seated in a classroom of small children when our country was so obviously under a terrorist attack. In between panic and hysteria, in between hoping that my husband would get out of the World Trade Center alive and wondering how I would ever break this news to my children, I also wondered why the Secret Service was letting the president stay in the classroom full of children. Why didn't they whisk him away? It seemed as if every target in America was being attacked. So wasn't the president, the leader of the free world, in danger of being fatally attacked as well? Weren't the children who were in the classroom with the president in danger too? After 2 days and hundreds of phone calls to New York City hospitals and to the Red Cross, receiving no guidance and absolutely no answers, my husband's employer, Howard Lutnick, the CEO of Cantor Fitzgerald, recounted on a news program that no one who was in the offices of Cantor Fitzgerald at the time of the attacks had survived. That meant that Ken was gone. My looming and painful question as to whether or not my husband had survived was now answered. We now knew that the time for hoping was over. Our lives were forever changed. My children would never again see their father, and I was now a widow. The grieving was just beginning. With what felt like a gaping hole in my heart, with two traumatized teens to now raise alone, I wondered if I would ever feel like eating or breathing again. For me, one horribly sad question had been answered, but many more questions would soon follow. The questions began to gnaw at me slowly at first. I wondered how on earth almost 2 hours could have passed with four domestic commercial airplanes flying around the skies of America without a response from our military. I began to Google search and read whatever articles and timelines I could get my hands on. Once I began my research into 9/11, I found it hard to leave the computer. Because I was unable to sleep and because I needed desperately to reconstruct and understand the events of 9/11, it began to appear to those close to me that I was shackled to the computer, and I have to admit, in a manner of speaking, I was. Having connected with a few other widows, it was not long before we were all researching the events, while we waited for an official inquiry into the attacks to be initiated. Then the news came. Only intelligence agency failures would be examined. How could that be? Our husbands were killed at their desks when commercial airplanes flew into their office buildings. They had no means of escaping and had practically no chance of evacuating on 9/11. The buildings that were supposedly so magnificently designed had collapsed in minutes. Why would the investigation of our loved ones' murders be limited to only intelligence agencies? What about airline security, high-rise building security, and border security? What about the FAA, the Port Authority, the Secret Service, and NORAD, all of whom were partly to blame for the failures that allowed the 9/11 attacks to occur? Didn't those areas and entities need to be investigated too? Incredulous but undeterred, we realized that it was necessary to take a thorough and independent look at what had gone wrong on 9/11. Our children were going to have to grow up in this changed world, and we needed to make sure that this could never happen again. We knew that with the 3,000 deaths on 9/11, there remained thousands of questions that needed to be answered. So we fought for the creation of the 9/11 Commission, and with all of America by our side, we finally won that battle. The commission was passed into law in the autumn of 2002, and by January 2003, the commission finally sat down to commence its very important work. The 9/11 Commission's report is 1 year old today. This report was supposed to provide the definitive account of what had transpired on September 11, 2001. We hoped that our thousands of unanswered questions would be addressed and answered. Yet, incredibly, we have found that the commission's definitive final report has actually yielded more questions than answers. Moreover, there are still so many areas that remain unexplained or only vaguely touched upon by the 9/11 Commission, so much so that it was quite difficult for me to decide where I should start my testimony to you today. One, the timeline of 9/11, the story of seismic information. I will begin with what I had first hoped for from the Commission. I believe that we needed the official timeline, the official and definitive timeline for 9/11. One of my questions had to do with the time that Flight 93 officially crashed. The Commission report says United 93 crashed in Pennsylvania at 10:03:11 a.m. and adds that the precise crash time has been the subject of dispute. In footnote 168 of Chapter 1, it says, quote, "We also reviewed a report regarding seismic observations on September 11, 2001, whose authors concluded that the impact time of United 93 was 10:06:05. Seismic data reflects the time that the Earth shook in response to the crash. Atomic clocks are used to record this data. I personally spoke with the men whose names appear on the seismic data report from 9/11. They received calls from the 9/11 Commission, too. I asked the seismologists, unless data existed that showed that the Earth also shook at 10:03 a.m., how could the Commission affix the time of Flight 93's crash to 10:03? They couldn't give me an answer, nor apparently could the commissioners in their final report. The crash of Flight 93 is one of the major events of 9/11. If we couldn't figure out what time that crash occurred, how could we ever understand the real complexities of the day? Perhaps most alarmingly, what does this say about the quality of the rest of the work product in the final report if the Commission could not accurately isolate this easily defined piece of information? Two, warnings, the story of ignored warnings by individuals. At 1:47 p.m. on September 11, 2001, while aboard Air Force One, Ari Fleischer was asked the following question by Press Briefing Pool. Quote, "Had there been any warnings that the president knew of?" Close quote. Mr. Fleischer answered simply, quote, "No warnings." No warnings. From my simple research using Google on my home computer, I learned that there were plenty of warnings. For example, newspapers in England, France, Germany, and Russia reported that there were indeed many warnings delivered to the Bush administration throughout the spring and summer of 2001. German intelligence warned both American and Israeli agencies that terrorists might be planning to hijack commercial aircraft to use them as weapons and to attack important American targets. During the G8 summit in Genoa, Italy, during the month of July 2001, Egypt warned of a plot to use airplanes to attack President Bush while he was there for the summit. As an aside, this warning was taken so seriously that anti-aircraft missiles were deployed near the Columbus Airport in Italy. Even ABC News reported Bush administration officials acknowledged that U.S. intelligence officials informed President Bush weeks before the September 11th attacks that bin Laden's terrorist network might try to hijack American planes. Likewise, Newsweek reported that as many as 10 to 12 warnings were issued, and more than two of the warnings specifically mentioned the possibilities of hijackings. Similarly, George Tenet was issuing many warnings that bin Laden was the most immediate threat to Americans. Indeed, the al-Qaeda warnings were dire enough in May of 2001 to motivate President Bush to appoint Vice President Cheney to head a task force to combat terrorist attacks on the United States. As reported by the Washington Post, President Bush said that Vice President Cheney would direct a government-wide review on managing the consequences of a domestic terrorist attack. And Vice President Cheney was quoted as saying, "I will periodically chair a meeting of the National Security Council to review these efforts." But according to the Washington Post, neither Cheney's review nor Bush's took place. The 9/11 report chose not to address any of the aforementioned warnings, and thus, in my opinion, did not answer the most important question, which was, with all of these warnings, why were we still so ill-prepared? 3. That's not connected, the story of David Frasca. It would seem that the Radical Fundamentalist Unit, the RFU, at FBI headquarters was in receipt of various pieces of information that, if put together, should have allowed them to see that a threatening pattern involving persons of interest was emerging during the summer of 2001. For example, the RFU was in receipt of both the Phoenix memo, the FBI memo that suggested there was a pattern of suspicious activity involving large numbers of Arab men taking flying lessons in American flight schools, and the FBI's file on Zacharias Moussaoui, an Arab man who was enrolled in an American flight school and fit the profile of a terrorist. While the 9/11 Commission goes into much detail about the facts surrounding the Phoenix memo and the case of Zacharias Moussaoui, they do not mention perhaps the most damning of all facts involving both issues, namely, that it was only two individuals at the RFU who received the Phoenix memo and the Moussaoui information within weeks of each other. It is likewise those same individuals who are responsible for the Phoenix memo being downplayed and all but ignored. FBI supervisor David Frasca and his underling Michael Maltby not only failed to permit FBI agents to request a FISA warrant for Moussaoui, but also altered the agent's initial request for it. Specifically, on August 28, 2001, Maltby edited the Minnesota FBI's request for a FISA warrant to search Zacharias Moussaoui's possessions. The Minnesota FBI field office wanted to prove that Moussaoui was connected to al-Qaeda through a rebel group in Chechnya, but the RFU agent Maltby removed the information connecting the Chechenian rebels to al-Qaeda. Subsequently, the FBI deputy general counsel who received the edited request, scrubbed clean of any international terrorist ties, decided that there wasn't enough of a connection between Moussaoui and al-Qaeda to allow an application for a search warrant through FISA. Thus, a FISA warrant was never even applied for. Later, in a report released on June 9, 2005, the FBI's Inspector General's office, far from downplaying this exchange, cited a top FBI lawyer's statement that, quote, he had never seen a supervisory special agent in headquarters so adamant that a FISA warrant could not be obtained, and at the same time, a field office so adamant that it could, close quote. The report also noted that the Minneapolis field office sought an expedited FISA, which it explained normally involved reports of suspected imminent attack or other imminent danger, a FISA warrant. Moussaoui's laptop was finally searched after the 9/11 attacks. German telephone numbers were found, as was the name Ahad Sabet. The numbers led the FBI to determine that the name Ahad Sabet was an alias for Ramzi bin al-Shib, former roommate of Mohammed Atta, the pilot of American Airlines Flight 11, which crashed into Tower 1, my husband's building, on 9/11. Agents also discovered that Ramzi bin al-Shib had wired money to Moussaoui in the summer of 2001. In addition, they found a document connecting Moussaoui with the Malaysian Yazid Sufat, a connection that could have led them to 9/11 hijackers Khalid al-Madar and Nawaf al-Hazmi. Those were two of the hijackers said to have crashed Flight 77 into the Pentagon. Both al-Madar and al-Hazmi lived in San Diego, California, had their names blatantly published in the San Diego phone book, and had contacts with individuals under FBI investigation. At the time of Moussaoui's arrest, one FBI agent commented in his case notes quite prophetically that Moussaoui seemed like a man who was capable of flying airplanes into the World Trade Center. 6. Planes as missiles, the story of the PDB. In spite of many explicit warnings, National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice claimed that the administration was never warned of an attack before 9/11. She went on national TV and stated, "I don't think anybody could have predicted that they would try to use an airplane as a missile, a hijacked airplane as a missile." However, as previously recounted, there were many warnings that terrorists might use planes as missiles. How could the National Security Advisor to the President of the United States not have been aware of this possibility? Further, why, if this was indeed a breakdown of communication within the executive branch of our government, wasn't that addressed by the Commission? If the vital flow of information from the agencies to the National Security Advisor was somehow hampered, wouldn't we need to understand how and why this was in order to make sure that the proper channels of information to and from the executive branch were operational in the future? While Condoleezza Rice seems to have failed in her capacity as National Security Advisor to inform President Bush of such warnings, there were many others within the President's cadre of advisors who also could have apprised him of the same information. Yet, on 5/17/02, President Bush also seemed to have no idea about the threat, saying, "Had I known that the enemy was going to use airplanes to kill on that fateful morning, I would have done everything in my power to protect the American people." And to our further dismay, when Condoleezza Rice testified before the Commission in April of 2004, we learned that on August 6, 2001, the President had been briefed by the CIA about just such a possibility. Although Ms. Rice argued during her testimony that the Presidential Daily Brief of August 6, 2001 was historical in nature and didn't warn of a domestic threat, the title of the PDB was "Bin Laden Determined to Strike in the United States." The title alone reveals that the document did indeed refer to a domestic threat and was, in fact, not a historical recap. At one point, to clarify and dispel the purely historical argument, I color-coded the PDB so that everyone could see exactly what parts of the PDB said that the threat was both domestic and current. I have done the same for this hearing. The orange is the domestic threat, and where it's yellow, highlighted in yellow, it's in the present tense. It's current on both pages. An example of the current and domestic threat in the text of the August 6, 2001 PDB was the statement, "Nevertheless, FBI information since that time indicates patterns of suspicious activity in this country consistent with preparation for hijackings or other types of attacks, including recent surveillance of federal buildings in New York." Why did the 9/11 Commission fail to call Ms. Rice to account for her deliberately misleading public statements? Why wouldn't the Commission address the discrepancies between the sworn testimony and uncovered facts? Not holding witnesses accountable for the veracity of their sworn testimony undermines the process. 7. Patterns of hijacking, the story of 52 warnings. We also hoped that the 9/11 Commission would explain the patterns of hijacking language found in the PDB. Where did this information come from? Perhaps it originated with the FAA. The explanation was not found in the final report released on July 22, 2004. But months later, when the second monograph was finally made public that the Commission had produced, we learned that there had been actually 52 warnings issued by the FAA during the 6 months preceding 9/11. So when on September 11, 2001, Ari Fleischer, the White House press secretary, said there were no warnings, what could he have possibly meant? And what exactly did our government do with the 52 warnings it received during the summer of 2001? If nothing was done with regard to said warnings, why was that? And whose job was it to make sure that appropriate defensive action was taken? At the very least, directives could have been issued to airport screeners to be on the lookout for certain types of suspicious behaviors. On February 11, 2005, in response to the Commission's release of its FAA monograph, we sent out another press release. We stated, "Notably missing from this monograph is any information pertaining to NORAD's failure to scramble jets in a timely manner, which leads us to wonder what else is being withheld from the public." We went on to state, of the 105 warnings issued, 52 warnings regarding Al-Qaeda were given to the FAA by the intelligence community in a six-month period from April 2001 to September 2001. According to the 9/11 Commission's final report, there were 8 information circulars put out by the FAA between July 2nd and September 10, 2001. 5 of these information circulars targeted overseas threats, while the remaining 3 targeted domestic threats. And finally, we stated, the 52 threats regarding Al-Qaeda were not received by the FAA in a vacuum. From March 2001 to September 2001, according to the Joint Inquiry of Congress, our intelligence community received at least 41 specific threats of a possible domestic attack by Al-Qaeda. Additionally, the FAA was also made aware of the August 15, 2001 arrest of Zacharias Moussaoui. And finally, the FAA attended a high-level meeting on July 5, 2001, where the domestic threat posed by Al-Qaeda was discussed by all relevant intelligence agencies. The FAA monograph reveals that in the spring of 2001, the FAA had already determined that if the intent of the hijacker is not to exchange hostages for prisoners, but to commit suicide in a spectacular explosion, a domestic hijacking would probably be preferable. It would seem that during the summer of 2001, there were indeed enough warnings and concern that all agencies should have been put on alert. 9, air defense, the story of NORAD's belated response. In other defense capacities on the morning of 9/11, the Commission's report discusses the actions of the FAA, NORAD, and NEADS. In particular, I make reference to footnote number 116, page 458, which says that on 9/11, NORAD was scheduled to conduct a military exercise, Vigilant Guardian, which postulated a bomber attack from the former Soviet Union. We investigated whether military preparations for the large-scale exercise compromised the military's response to the real-world terrorist attack on 9/11. Accordingly, the newly sworn-in Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Eberhardt, said that it took the military about 30 seconds to make the adjustment to the real-world situation. But the following words, which show there was confusion, have troubled me since my research began. NEADS, this comes from the Commission report and from the day of 9/11 transcripts. NEADS, is this real world or exercise? FAA, no, this is not an exercise, not a test. On page 20, we note more confusion. NEADS did not know where to send the alert fighter aircraft, and the officer directing the fighters pressed for more information. Quote, I don't know where I'm scrambling these guys to. I need a direction, a destination, close quote. And on page 26, NORAD heard nothing about the search for American 77. Instead, the NEADS air defenders heard renewed reports about a plane that no longer existed, American 11. At 9:21, NEADS received a report from the FAA. FAA, Military Boston Center, I just had a report that American 11 is still in the air and on its way towards, heading toward Washington. NEADS, okay, American 11 is still in the air? FAA, yes. NEADS, on its way toward Washington? FAA, it was evidently another aircraft that hit the tower. That's the latest report we have. NEADS, okay. FAA, I'm going to try to confirm an ID for you, but I would assume he's somewhere over New Jersey or somewhere further south. NEADS, okay, so American 11 isn't the hijack at all then? FAA, no, he's a hijack. NEADS, American 11 is a hijack? FAA, yes. NEADS, and he's heading into Washington? FAA, yes, this could be a third aircraft. The mention of a third aircraft was not a reference to American 77. As the Commission report says, there was confusion at that moment in the FAA. And General Eberhardt's claim that the military exercises somehow made the military better prepared on 9/11 does not ring true. Instead, it appears that the concurrent military exercises completely confused everyone. Thus far, we are still waiting for the monograph on the failures of NORAD that the Commission said it would produce. We asked for an independent commission to investigate 9/11 because that was the only tool that we, as American citizens, had access to, and hoped that our leaders, the members of Congress and the American public, would ensure its validity and that its ensuing recommendations would make us all safer, all as safe as we could reasonably expect to be in the event of another attack. Sadly, as Americans, we have all been let down.
We'll begin our question.